Hello, my name is Saptak Sen. I'm a senior product manager in the Microsoft Azure Data Platform team. So today we are going to spend some time going through our overall Azure Data Platform and specifically focus on big data. And with me, I have Bill Ramos.
Thank you, Saptak. My name is Bill Ramos. I'm a VP of Consulting Services with Advaya, and I'm going to be the demo master for these presentations.
Awesome. So let's get started. Now, before we get started, let's quickly cover what we are going to cover, the topics that we are going to cover in this module. We are going to look up, we are going to first figure out why big data. Then we are going to look about, talk about the big data Lambda architecture. And finally, we are going to see what are the different capabilities of the Azure Data Platform to get you started on your first big data project. Now, why big data? Now, I think these are the four basic drivers for big data. Different people have different opinions. If you ask in a room full of people, you'll find many, many different opinions. But as I have gone around, talked to customers, I think these are some of the key drivers. The first one, human fault tolerance. I don't mean it's the capability to tolerate other people's fault, but it's more like we make mistakes. We make mistakes in our lives, we make mistakes in our work. Which DBA hasn't deleted a database by mistake? Everyone has. I mean, every database administrator worth their salt have. That's almost their point of graduation. Now, this kind of mistakes happen. So we need to have a system which can tolerate this. That's what I mean by human fault tolerance. And sometimes these faults that happen due to human error or even malicious and intent, you know, can cost millions or billions of dollars in data loss, especially in this today's world where we depend on more and more data. The second key driver is to minimize CapEx. So if, again, in this new world of, you know, lean and agile, nobody wants to invest upfront a ton of money. They want to say, hey, if you've got a project idea, let's go start up something in a very small scale without any CapEx, see how it goes, and then we can, as it becomes more and more useful, we can, you know, put more and more money in. At that point, it will be much more justifiable to grow this or grow our investments around this. And the third aspect is, although we want to start small, but our ambitions are bigger than ever. So we want to have design systems and know that our platforms can scale when we really, really grow up or when we really, really become popular and so on. So hyperscale on demand is almost as a necessity. Without that assurance that even if we start small, we can grow really big, no one wants to bet on that platform, that technology, or that architecture. The fourth aspect is low learning curve. We have so many things to learn, to grasp within our brain. We no longer have the luxury of spending, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of learning a particular technology, because by the time we learn and gain that expertise, that technology has become obsolete. Something new and cooler has come around. So we have to be very, very agile, have a low learning curve in picking up these technologies. Now, you may ask, what's all this got to do with big data? Now, in today's world where, you know, big data is flooding us in, all these requirements are even more important than a small data project. Because, you know, of course, you know, most of us start small and then grow big, so hyperscale is very important. We still don't want to spend upfront, so CapEx is important. We don't want to lose big data in a hurry or in a jiffy due to either mistake or malicious intent by some operator, so that human fault tolerance is important. So I guess I made this point well enough. Now, what stands between us and building such a platform which fulfills all these requirements? It's what we call the CAP theorem. Now, CAP is an acronym. It stands for consistency, for C, availability, A, and partition tolerance. Now, let's go through each one of these. Now, we all know, if you have played with relational databases and relational database technology, you know the ACID, right? Atomicity, consistency, isolations, and durability. Those four properties are the foundations of every relational database. Consistency is the same C as in ACID. It's the ability to, or the assurance that at any point, all the different data structures are consistent with each other. So when you are doing a query and getting data from all these different data structures, you are getting a consistent result set back. That's what consistent means. Availability, of course, means the fact that when you query your data, your query is returned within a certain SLA time, so or returns at all, right? So your database infrastructure is not down or sluggish, which doesn't meet SLA, right? That's availability. And then the third part, which is very important for big data platform, is partition tolerance. Now let me take a step back and tell you why we need partition tolerance. Traditionally, we have seen database systems scale up. As you put more and more data, you have more and more storage, you have more and more memory, you have more and more CPU horsepower, and so on, and you scale up. But there is a limit to scale up. The limits are the most crucial limit is the disk I/O. Disk I/O, the increase in disk I/O bandwidth hasn't kept pace with, say, the amazing advancement we've got from CPU, the clock speed increase or the number of cores in a CPU and so on. So that's, you know, even memory has become extremely inexpensive comparatively, and you can get a lot of memory in the system. But disk, which is one of the slowest subsystem in any computer, the moment you have to touch the disk, you know, your performance goes out of the window. So if you are trying to scan a terabyte of data on a single hard drive, although you have the storage capacity because you can very easily 2 or 3 terabyte drives, it takes a long time to scan that terabyte of data. So the way to overcome that is to partition that data, that terabyte of data, let's say, across many drives. And in especially in the world of big data, when we are not just talking about 1 terabyte, when we are talking about, you know, tens of terabytes or even hundreds of terabytes, it's all the more important that that data is sharded or partitioned across many drives. And when we do that, when the data is partitioned across many drives and many systems, when we query such a system, it needs to be partition tolerant to return you a consistent result set again. So these three are the three kind of the vertex of our trade-off triangle, so to say. The CAP theorem says that you can get only two of these three, right? So that's the challenge. You either have to give up consistency or availability or partition tolerance. Oftentimes, you can sacrifice a little bit on the consistency and gain on availability and partition tolerance. Now, that forces us to have two separate systems. One where consistency is paramount importance, like any transactional system. And then the analytic system where you really need to scale out because you have your big data and you need to be available, it to be available all the time. There you can sacrifice the consistency cranking up availability and partition tolerance. Now, what's the solution for this? You know, big data Lambda architecture, and it is a community proposed architecture, addresses some of the challenges we have that we discussed in the last slide. Let's talk about how it addresses some of the challenges. Now, it proposes that we break up our data infrastructure, not break up, have essentially three parts to our data infrastructure: the batch layer, the speed layer, and the serving layer. Let's look at each of this layer a little bit more in detail. The batch layer. Now, batch layer stores an immutable data set. So as more and more data comes in, it keeps adding data to it. You cannot update any data to it. Data already stored in it. You can only add to it. The reason is that, remember, one of the requirements, the ability to tolerate human fault. And that human fault could be accidental or malicious, but so in such a to guarantee that, you need to make sure that nobody can delete or can update data in place. They can only add to it. If something has changed, a state has changed, it needs to come in as additional data with the timestamp and the new state, right? So that tells us that the state has changed. So we really don't need to delete or update data. That's the key thing. The other requirement is that it needs to be horizontally scalable. What that means is that today I cannot foresee how much data storage or, you know, data query capacity I would require in 6 months from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now. I need to be able to grow that. I need to be able to horizontally scale. I cannot scale up because there's no way I can get a bigger machine, right? And even if I can, it's extremely expensive. I don't have to invest upfront on that big machine, right? I can keep adding storage and processing as I go along. Of course, this has some challenges. It gives us a system which has high latency, right? Because it provides some benefits of that, which is unrestrained computation or arbitrary queries, right? I can query anything, form any query to this system and fire to it. And it's going to go scan through all that data and eventually come back with that result. So that means I can't design indexes which speeds up queries for only certain queries. Even if I have design indexes for certain queries, any queries which doesn't match those that index design will still take longer. So it is, for most queries, it will have high latency. But the benefit is that I can do any arbitrary query to this data. So that's the nature of the batch layer. Let's talk about the speed layer a little bit. Now, speed layer addresses some of the shortcomings of the batch layer. So speed layer, as data is coming in, it does near real time. Now, real time is, of course, depends on the definition. Hardware manufacturer or real time operating system guys, for them it's like picoseconds and microseconds is what real time means. But for us, real time means within seconds or so on. So as data is flowing in, I can apply some kind of analytics and processing when it's flying in. And I can store the raw data into the data lake, the immutable data store, which is the batch layer. But at the same time, I'm going to talk about another layer pretty soon, the serving layer. I can update the serving layer with some of the crucial information. So what this gives me is to cut down the latency, high latency we talked about in the batch layer. The high latency prevents us from getting up to the minute updates through the serving layer. So through speed layer, I can address some of that. Also, if there is any mistake or any human error that happens in the speed layer by faulty rules or whatever, we can recover from that because we have the raw data stored in the batch layer always. We can throw out everything that the speed layer has done and updated to the serving layer. We can throw that part out, and then we can update the entire serving layer from the batch layer. So that gives us some insurance against any issues or errors and so on. So let's talk about the serving layer. Serving layer, as you would have imagined by now, is where it lets you do low latency query against the data. So as data is coming in through the speed layer updates the serving layer in near real time, within seconds or minutes, whatever your organization's SLA is, whatever you can tolerate. And then the speed layer also stores the raw data into the batch layer. And over time, say nightly or weekly, again, whatever your latency tolerant is, you can have a much richer computed views and indexes which gets updated into the serving layer to provide that low latency interaction that the end users need with their data. Because, frankly, who wants to kind of go to a web page, click a button, and come back in 5 days to see the results, right? Or even 5 minutes to see the results. They want it immediately. If you are using Excel Connect, you want to see things happening immediately, irrespective of how small or how big the data is. So this serving layer is crucial in providing that that kind of a low latency interaction possible. So with that, in our Azure data platform, we have many different capabilities and technologies. Here are some of the pieces and how they fall in the different layers. Let's talk about some real life case studies. Let's talk about Yahoo. Yahoo actually had a project called the Tau project, and this project came out from the collaboration between Microsoft and Yahoo after the partnership around the search engine went through. So whenever you go and search something on Yahoo, it's the Bing search engine which powers those queries. But everything else on that page, search page, the advertisements and other content on that page is provided by Yahoo. Now, the data analysts at Yahoo obviously are very interested in knowing how effective all that content around the search is. So they want to know the or look at the clickstream data from the Yahoo search pages. Now, there's a collaboration between Bing and Yahoo where Bing provides multiple terabytes of data every day to Yahoo around all this clickstream data. And the Yahoo data analysts need to very quickly, put it in a serving layer so that they can interact with the BI tools and other tools that they're used to. So, if you didn't know, it's one of the key technologies around big data, Hadoop, was created by Yahoo, right? And open sourced it, of course. But they decided they're going to use Hadoop to extract the interesting entities from that raw clickstream data that Microsoft was providing it to Yahoo. But when they extracted that information, that they wanted to stage it into a low latency data store so that their traditional BI tools can go against it. So they chose SQL Server Analysis Services as the platform of their choice, where they can now use Excel, Tableau, other Microsoft BI tools to go interact with it. And in fact, the SQL Server Analysis Services Cubes, a couple of years back, was 24 terabytes. It has grown since. It's a partitioned cube, and it provides that low latency access to insights from the familiar tools. Now let's talk about Ferranti. Now, in case of Ferranti, again, they had a lot of streaming data coming in to the batch layer, which is Azure HD Insight Services. Now, once they have that data and they run their HD Insight jobs to extract the interesting entities, they surface that data through SQL Server in-memory OLTP, which is often known as Hackathon, or they also can subscribe to that data through the reactive extensions. And we are going to talk about reactive extensions in a later module. We are going to see some demos. What it lets you do is to subscribe to some of the key business rules getting fulfilled when it can be alerted, your application can be alerted, in short. With that, let's go on to the first, the demo. And Bill is going to show you how to set up this batch layer that we talked about so much on top of Hadoop, so Hadoop HD Insight Service.
Yep. Thank you, Saptak. Okay, to create a storage account, first thing I'm going to do, which I've already done here, is navigate to my manage.windowsazure.com URL. I've already signed in to my account, and this shows all the items that I have in here. To set up the storage, I'll go click on the storage icon right here, and then go ahead and select New, Quick Create, and then give it the name of my URL. And in this case, it's going to be BigData.js. Next, I need to define the location of this. Now, the location is important because I need to match it up with where I'm going to be creating my HD Insight cluster. In this case, I know it's going to be West US. Likewise, I'm going to turn off the geo-replication because in this case, I don't want to incur the extra expenses here. I'll go ahead now and create the storage account. So what's happening now is Windows Azure is going through a process of defining the storage, setting up a URL for it, and then going ahead and enabling it to allow me to create containers and things. Now these containers will allow me to store the data files that I'll use for my HD Insight operations. So I'm going to go ahead and let this go through the creation process now. Okay, now the Windows Azure is resolving the namespace for the storage, and so this is kind of the last step in the process before it brings it online. So let's go ahead and wait for this to finish resolving. Okay, now our storage is online. The next thing I can do is start to create containers within that storage. So to do that, I'll go ahead and click on the account and click on containers. And this shows me that I have no containers, so very easily I can click on the create a container. And I'm going to go ahead and create one called working. And then go ahead and click the check. And so now I have a container, I can use this to insert blobs. When I go ahead later and create my HD Insight cluster, it'll actually create its own container in here. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Saptak here.
So let's discuss a little bit about the Azure Blob Store. Now, whenever he was mentioning storage, he was referring it to the Azure Blob Store. Now, Azure Blob Store, as we discussed, is a distributed storage, right, on top of Azure. And it's very simple and transparent to you because you don't need to worry about how many nodes, you know, how it's distributed, whether it's fault tolerant or not. Everything is taken care of, or how to configure the fault tolerance. So everything is taken care of. So for you, it looks like one giant unlimited hard drive in the sky. You can keep putting data into that storage account. Now, the only aspect is that it doesn't have a folder hierarchy in it. It's a single level storage. So every storage has an account associated with it. So if you have a subscription, Azure subscription, that's your account, right? And within the account, you can have multiple containers. Now, containers are structures which provides you a way to kind of almost logically separate different kind of data that you want to store. And within the container itself, you can have multiple blobs or files or however you might want to refer it to them. And then within that, there are then pages and blocks which you don't need to really worry about most of the time. Now, when we will use HD Insight, and Bill is going to show the demo in next step, HD Insight is basically 100% Apache Hadoop. So Apache Hadoop expects a file system structure, right? It expects some kind of folder structure and so on. So that is emulated on this blob storage. So with that,
let's go ahead and create the cluster.
Let's go ahead and create the cluster.
Okay. So what we're going to do now is create the cluster. By doing that, I'll go ahead and select this cylinder with all the jumbled lines here. That's our HD Insight cluster. And now I'll use the create command to go ahead and get things started. Next, I'll specify the cluster name as part of the quick create as, again, Big Data JS, which is the same name as our storage node. It doesn't have to be that. I just using it for convenience here. I then need to specify the admin password, so I'll type that in and then confirm it. And then I need to specify my storage account. Now, it looks like it by default it chose the storage account that I just created. There are other storage accounts that I have in my list here that I could have used as well that are all associated with the Western United States data center. So I'll go ahead and keep that as is and create the cluster. So what's happening now, let me go to details here, is there's a process of submitting the cluster request, having it accepted, and then building out the cluster. And so once the cluster's gone through the acceptance process, it's creating its head node and the compute nodes that are associated with the four nodes that we defined. Now, this is obviously a lot easier than trying to configure your own virtual machines and installing something like the Horton DataWorks on top of that. This is taking care of it all for you as part of the HT Insight cluster creation process. Next, as part of this process creation effort, it's going to go ahead and create the VMs and then go ahead and configure the cluster with all the appropriate software and then provision the container associated with that. So I'm going to go ahead and let this run. The process takes about 10 to 12 minutes, and we'll come back when the cluster is all created. Okay, we can see here in the user interface that it's in the process of doing this Windows Azure VM creation. While that's going on, I'm going to go ahead and shift over because one of the things we're going to do in the next example is load some data, and I'm going to need to use PowerShell to do that. Now, I have a script file already set up for the demonstration. So we've seen here we've gone ahead and created our HT Insight cluster, and we're going to go later on and load in the data. But what I want to do is configure my cluster or my PowerShell environment. There's a couple things I needed to do. First off, by going to the URL, if you search for install and configure PowerShell for HD Insight, that's going to take you to a web page right here that explains, what you need to do step by step to configure PowerShell for HD Insight. Now, I've already gone through the process of installing Windows Azure PowerShell, and that's installed through the Windows Platform Installer. The next thing I already did was install the PowerShell tools for Windows Azure, and this is the new set of commandlets that are available for the general availability of HD Insight. These have changed quite a bit since prior versions, so you'll want to go ahead, if you've used it before, get the latest commandlets here. The next thing you have to do is this process of get Azure publish settings file. I'm going to go ahead and show you what that process looks like when we do it. So I'll go ahead, and what you do is within the PowerShell ISE here, which I loaded up my PowerShell commandlet in, I'm just going to go ahead and execute it. When you execute it, it literally goes over and launches a web page and asks for you to download publish settings file. And so what you do is you specify where you want to have that saved off. Now, I've already got it saved off in my C:data directory. And so you can put it anywhere, but you're going to have to refer back to it. The next thing you're going to do is then import that Azure published settings file. And you specify where you set that, where you have your file downloaded to. And when you run that, that will go ahead and set up all the subscription information so that you can now use PowerShell to communicate with Windows Azure. Now, this is a one-time operation. So once you've set it up, every time you go into PowerShell subsequently, it will go ahead and keep that Azure subscription information. To make sure everything's right, I'm going to go ahead and execute this get Azure subscription command file with the default parameter, and that will go ahead and display the subscription information. So this is confirming that I now have Windows Azure properly confirmed or configured. Next, what I'm going to do is set up some variables that I'm going to use to reference the HD Insight cluster. And so by doing this, I'm going to set a subscription ID, which is going to take the ID value out of the subscription information that I just showed you, set that up, set up a cluster name, storage, and container name. So I'll go ahead and execute that. And next, I'm going to go ahead and get credentials. Now, this is a very nice feature that the HD Insight team added here, where it actually displays a prompt and can hide the credentials here. And I'm going to go ahead and type in the admin and the password that I used earlier. So now I have my credentials. The next thing I do is I'm going to get the storage key. And that's going to allow my commandlets to do the uploads later on. So I'm going to go ahead and run that. And if I go ahead and go $ key here, you can see the key information that's needed for the next thing. To go ahead and get my storage pre-configured, I then use this new Azure storage context where I give it the storage account name. In this case, again, it's the Big Data JS and the key here. And so I'll go ahead and execute that. And now I have context set up. Let's take a look at what that looks like through the context variable. So this just has a storage account name, the endpoints for the storage. Now, what I wanted to show you is that you can actually get the status of where your Azure cluster is by using this get Azure HD Insight cluster command with the subscription info. By executing that, we indicated that we've got an error here, which I'll have to diagnose here in a little bit. So we'll just pause right here, and we'll go back to our Azure screen. Right here. And we'll see here that we're still configuring our Windows Azure VM configuration. So I'm going to go ahead and let this continue out until it's done. And I'll get back to it when we're done here. Okay, our HD Insight cluster is now created. You can see the steps that it ran through for submitting, accepted, the VMware creation, the HD Insight configuration, and now it's running. So we can actually do some stuff on our cluster at this point. So I'll go ahead and clear that out, and I'm going to go over to our, PowerShell ISE. Okay, the problem that we had earlier when I tried to run the get HD Insight cluster command was that I didn't have the latest set of Windows Azure PowerShell tools installed, and so it told me that I needed to install 7.0. So in this PowerShell ISE, I have 7.0 installed, and so I'm going to go ahead and rerun the setup variables that I did right here and set up again my Azure storage key, because I'm going to need this before I start the upload, and then go ahead and set up my context for my Azure storage commandlets. So with that, I can then see now when I do the get HD Insight cluster commandlet, you'll see here the information for our cluster, including kind of the URL to the cluster console, indicates that I'm running, tells you I'm running under the admin account, in the location of the Western United States data center, along with my blob storage content. Now, what I need to do is download some files from the Census Bureau that I'm going to upload into HD Insight. And where I'm going to go ahead and get those from is over here at the U.S. Census Bureau. They have a site here where you can get race data and other census data by county. And so what I'm going to do is go ahead and do a save target as, and in this case I've got to make sure I get the file name right, so I'm going to go ahead and call this census data1.dat and go ahead and copy that to the clipboard and back over here, paste, and save that file off. And I'm going to do the same thing with the second file. So I'll go ahead, save target as, and then save that as 2. Now that I have my files here, I'll go ahead and open the folder, and I have to correct one thing, because all the file layout information in here and all that stuff is all there specified for you, but I need to fix up some stuff here. So I'm going to go ahead and open this in WordPad right now and kind of show you the file layout. So this is a comma-separated file. It has these fields called SUMLEV, state code, county code, and then we actually have the state name, county name, sex, and then around here is the age group, and then we have the population represented by that age group. Now, in order to process this data, I have to get rid of this header line. Again, in a big data scenario, you typically wouldn't have a header line like this because it would be machine-generated data. So I'll go ahead and save this off and close it down and do the same thing with our second file. So we'll go ahead and, again, open that with WordPad. And this is the second set of data from Montana on. And I'll go ahead and hit save here. So now I have my two files modified on my local disk in my data drive. The next thing I need to do is upload those to my Azure storage account. And the way that I'm going to do that is using this command called set Azure storage blob content. I give it the file name parameter, and so I'll specify the file. I then indicate the container that I'm going to put it in, the Big Data Jumpstart, and then the blob location where I want to put it. And this is going to go ahead and create an arbitrary directory structure under my container name that'll essentially be slash data census and then the name of the file where I want to have it end up. And I'm giving it the context of the storage account. So let me go ahead and I'll run this first one for you. And so what this is doing is saying, do I want to overwrite? And I'll say yes to all. I can get rid of that message by saying force. And I'll do that for the second one here. And you see when I run this, it gives me the information here, the file information. But I can go ahead and get a list of the files using the get Azure storage blob commandlet, indicate the container along with the context, and then I give it a wildcard specification for my blob. I'm going to have it format as a table. So this is a way to list out the files in your container. So I'll go ahead and run this, and you see here we have our two files uploaded as we expect to have them uploaded. So we have our data files now. We have our cluster configured. And I guess it's back to the slideware.
As you saw, we just set up one piece of the whole puzzle. That's the batch layer, right? Now, I wanted to give you a quick preview. We are going to talk about each one of these aspects in much more in detail, but a quick preview of what are the other pieces. Of course, means for BI, business intelligence, Excel is our cornerstone product. Now, within Excel, there are many capabilities. One of the new capabilities is like Power Query. Now, Power Query lets you connect to any data source or most data source and very easily consume and shape and feed that into a data model. Now, when I talk about data model, most of the time I'm talking about the Power Pivot model. Now, Power Pivot model is basically an in-memory vertipack cube, right, within Excel. Now, once you have it in that model, what you can do is then you can publish it to either SharePoint or in SQL Server Analysis Services. Now, you can also do visualization from it using Power View and so on. HD Insight we saw, and we will see much more in detail how to consume and process structured and unstructured data. And then, of course, we have the ability using things like Polybase. Now, Polybase is one of the key features of our parallel data warehouse appliance, which lets you query data stored on Hadoop in using a T-SQL, full fidelity T-SQL language. And it uses the SQL Server's query engine to create the artifacts or the predicates required to do those processing on Hadoop and push it down to Hadoop, does that processing, gives you back. For an end user or for an application, it's extremely simple. Most of the time, they don't even need to know that they are going against data stored on Hadoop. So the idea that we want to give through this slide is that here we are trying to provide you an end-to-end big data platform where we have all the different pieces required for your data insight scenarios all covered. And we are going to cover much more of those. Now, here are some links. In the meantime, if you want to get started, you can go directly on the MSDN blogs around HD Insight of what we did and much, much more. In this module, we covered, you know, the motivation around a big data infrastructure. We also covered how to create your own big data infrastructure on Azure and how simple it is. Now, in the next module, we are going to talk about how you can use MapReduce as your big data processing paradigm to process, you know, structured and unstructured data on top of Hadoop. So with that, we are going to come back in a few minutes with the next module.